Hey guys, so this is a spicy episode with Professor Barquet, someone who can be a bit controversial, especially for those who don't know what the carnivore diet is or who have never heard of Professor Barquet. We get into topics such as why veganism is in fact an anti-humanist ideology. We get into some of the biochemical processes behind the supposed insulin resistance and much, much more. So why should you listen or hear out someone like Professor Barquet? Well, despite the fact that he has a scientific background over 20 years working in the field of nutrition science, cardiovascular pathophysiology, and sports medicine, basically, he has clinical experience. He has seen patients. He's been in the real world seeing whether the theoretic things work out or not. What works, what doesn't, which a lot of scientists actually lack. Like, they're inside their laboratories, so they're controlling these little experiments. Everything is controlled for. But real life experience or real life application of a lot of these supposed nutritional theories are lacking. So this is why I consider him an important voice, whether you disagree with him or not, whether you like his personality or not. I think he adds a lot of value into the nutritional space, and in this case, also the carnivore space, because he can be a bit spicy amongst the carnivore community as well. Anyways, I hope you guys enjoy. But first, if you really like the podcast, you can support me by following me on Fountain or on Noster. You can also follow me on YouTube or on Spotify. And if you really, really like my podcast, you can support me by sending some sats my way. It would be greatly appreciated. Thank you very much. Okay, welcome everyone. Today we have a very special guest, Professor Barquet, very well known in the carnivore community. First time I have someone well known on my podcast as well. So, for those who will be listening to this later on YouTube, this goes to my Spanish-speaking audience. I will add subtitles to this. So we're going to cover really basic things right now, because I feel a lot of people in Mexico, Latin America in general, Spain, don't really know a lot of these general terms that I believe a lot of people in the English-speaking community and in the carnivore community already know. So we're going to be with very basic questions. First of all, Professor Barquet, before you introduce yourself, there's a lot of appeal to authority, especially I would say here in Latin America. So people care about titles and things and whatnot. So can you introduce yourself, but also could you present your credentials, and why should these appeal to authority people listen to someone like you?
Right. Okay. Well, for what it's worth, I had a 20 something year career in academia previously, where I taught three different specializations in 11 different universities and colleges on four different continents. And those specialities were the physiology and the physiology of rest and exercise, usually just called sports science, then human nutrition, then cardiovascular pathophysiology. What causes heart attacks and what doesn't? I published a number of peer-reviewed articles in my time, did a number of multi-million dollar external consultancies, did my teaching load, did 20 years of that, got no thanks for it, and decided to do my own thing. So these days my credentials are online influencer, if you like. However, I happen to have a little bit of knowledge in the field and am happy to espouse my ideas around that. It's all backed with, 20 plus years of working in science as a scientist, where you are required to back up everything you say with evidence that it's so, and to be disciplined about what you claim and what you don't claim. So that's my whole standpoint in terms of that. Why should someone listen to me? Well, I guess it's your decision. It's buyer beware a bit as to who you listen to. What I suggest you do is that you subject everything that you hear me say to a test of basic common sense. Does this guy make sense in what he says? While I have as many titles as you'd like, none of them actually mean that what I'm saying to you is correct necessarily. Appeal to authority is a form of fallacy at the end of the day. These days, certificates saying people are competent in this, that, and the other thing are actually given out more like lollies, sweets, than actual qualifications. When I started teaching about 20-something years ago, the primary thing that I was judged on as an academic was, what grades do my students get? By the end of it, I was judged on a thing called student satisfaction. How much did they like me? And science has lost its way completely. Scientists have lost their way completely. along with a societal loss of its way in terms of what's going on, academia has followed suit in similar ways. So unfortunately, someone coming to me with seven bits of paper saying they're competent in this, that, and the other thing will not impress me. Neither necessarily will a list of peer-reviewed publications even impress me. What will impress me is what comes out of someone's mouth. Have they got it? Do they understand? Unfortunately, it's a rare thing, in my opinion.
True.
So, there it is, for what it's worth. Yeah. Mm.
Perfect. Excellent. Yes, I think that's very important to sell the foundation for this. So I'm going to go for the Ugler. The science, in this case, nutrition science.
Yeah.
Nutrition science, the state it is in right now, how much can we trust it? And should we base our diet on the science, the nutritional science that is out there?
Right. Not at all. And no. There is absolutely nothing out there that would inform what a person should or should not eat in the so-called peer-reviewed literature concerning human nutrition. There are reductionist studies of a short-term nature and or a poorly controlled nature and or a directly pseudo-scientific nature, i.e. just rubbish. Or, on the other end of the spectrum, there are long-term prospective cohort studies with no attempt to control anything, no attempt to actually do any science, intervene in any way or do an experiment, just to observe what happens and report associations between X and Y with no reference in that case to an ability to inform on cause nor effect, but to claim cause and effect anyway on the basis of such studies, because discipline goes out the window. So
basically,
stuff that would actually do the stuff in the middle, the stuff that would be needed is not there and never will be there, can't be there. Ethically impossible, practically impossible, financially impossible. It's just not going to happen.
So like for the average layperson, it's because most of the studies done in nutritional science are observational studies, correct? And therefore, they're surveys, health surveys, like seeing what people were eating in the last year or so. Yeah, exactly. So what would be needed to know once and for all what a human should eat? Like what type of scientific experiment would be needed for that?
You would need to start with a very, very large number of sets of genetically and phenotypically identical individuals, sets of twins, and you would need to separate them at birth or beforehand, actually, put them into separate laboratories where absolutely everything that could possibly intervene in their health status is monitored, controlled, known about, not allowed to vary between the two twins. And only the thing that you want to point your finger at is either being good or bad. That's the only thing that's allowed to vary. These people need to remain in the lab, locked in the lab, under observation 24/7 for their entire lifespans to measure who gets what disease and who doesn't on that basis. And you'd have to do that for every single food item individually in isolation to everything else that could confound, destroy your ability to talk about cause. And it's just ridiculous. You cannot do that kind of science. Science, the scientific method, is not predisposed to answering these questions. And it never will be. So what we need to do is accept that fact rather than trying to obfuscate that, pull the wool over people's eyes and suggest that we're doing some really great science here in human nutrition studies, because we're not.
Because as a common argument, I guess, like vegans and people like that will say, like, okay, it's what we got. This is the science that we got. So we got to work with it. So basically, it's garbage. We can't really work with that. It's a pile of crap.
That's right. So what I'm saying is, we don't need to do with the best we've got with the best science we've got. What we need to do is be disciplined and honest with people about the level of science that we've got, which is none.
So what can we do? Are there any sciences? Sorry.
Well, we need to stop lying to people, for a start, about human nutrition science being science, because it isn't. And we need to look at some hard sciences that might help us inform on what was likely to be a sensible diet for a human being. So we need to use anthropologies, the various forms of anthropology. I would suggest stable isotope testing is a good one. because it informs absolutely unequivocally on what human beings did definitely eat for hundreds of thousands of years, which tells us absolutely what positive and negative selection pressures were at play, ergo how the genome of the human species has evolved over that time to be best conduced to living that lifestyle. Ergo, that's the thing that we should probably keep doing.
Would you include in this what do you include things like quantum biology, for example, and these type of hard sciences, or not really?
Well, quantum biology is not a hard science. That's another area of ideology that's come up recently that people are talking about as being a hard science, when actually what it is an opportunity for a number of people to yet more muddy the waters, obfuscate, and tell people, we can answer your affect, we can predict and explain how you interact with the world and your health status on the basis of quantum tunneling, for example, or some other thing. There are some valid concepts in quantum biology, you bet. There are some people talking in a valid way about some of those things, you bet. Dr. Sarah Pugh is an example. She does talk about it in an indicated and disciplined way, as opposed to others who may have perhaps popularized the quantum biology area. Perhaps somebody whose name might rhyme with Dr. Mac Fruz or something like that.
Yeah.
That individual does not speak about quantum biology in a way that is disciplined, indicated and useful to people. He spoke about it in a way that was inaccessible to people, precisely so that they couldn't challenge him and he could be the man, for example.
Interesting.
Now, Jack, that person and I, whose name might rhyme with Mac or Jack or Frack or anything else, is also someone who is acquainted to me. I do know him. I have spoken to him on a number of occasions, and I've said this stuff to his face. So I'm not talking about him behind his back. I've said it to his face. You need to stop doing that, I said to him all along. Anyway, as it turns out, he's been stopped now. So his channel's been taken down, is what I'm telling you.
Oh.
And it was nothing to do with me, by the way.
Yeah, I believe you. I believe you.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. Yeah. Really, honestly, it wasn't, because I actually am not against that individual or what he's doing. I just didn't necessarily think he was doing it the right way, but that was his call.
But things that you perhaps would you agree on, like deuterium, for example, as is that considered quantum biology? Or,
well, if you like,
or not really,
if you like, because it does speak about the difference between a hydrogen atom and a deuterium atom being problematic for the H0H1 ATPase synthesis of ATP, for example. And yes, it is potentially a problem. So minimizing the deuterium level, I suppose is the word, of your intakes is probably a good thing. Do we have any hard science to back that up? No, we don't. Do we have any experiments on people with different levels? No. It's one of those things that's theoretically a pretty sound idea. As opposed to an idea that's much more sound, so to harp back to it, let's measure the ratio of the isotopes of nitrogen, which is a stable isotope item, in the collagen, in the long bones of human skeletal remains of anything up to, they found 110 or 115,000 years old, I think. Measured it and gone, well, that's what that human being ate then in terms of their trophic level. How much animal material and how much plant material did that individual human being eat? And the answers from all over the world and thousands of different cases and hundreds of different studies in the literature are all pretty much in agreement. And they all say that human beings ate the flesh and associated fat of animals almost exclusively for hundreds of thousands of years prior to the agrarian revolution, which, as turns out, seems to be the second worst thing that humans ever did, nutrition-wise, to add plants to our diet. The worst thing we ever did was add industrialized seed oils. Seed oils was the worst, I believe.
Agreed. I think many would tend to agree to that. So you mentioned deuterium not being scientifically backed enough for to be conclusively seen as something that you should focus on. But I do know that you recommend grounding a lot. Is the science behind that also not as strong, yet you do consider it something important?
The first time that somebody suggested to me that electrical grounding was a good idea for health ongoingly, my response was, oh, for goodness sake, I'm a scientist. Why are you coming to me with this nonsense? And this person had enough gumption and enough brains to say to me, well, if you are a scientist, you'll go and check out whether what I've said is indeed backed by any science then, won't you? To which I had to respond, well, you got me there because I didn't know. I just reacted that way emotionally, completely unscientifically. Anyway, I went and looked at the literature, and there is pretty good indication by way of at least pilot studies for a number of different claims about the immediate health outcomes or changes in a person's health status or physiological status associated with grounding. So I thought, well, it also makes kind of sense. So to me, that's stronger, but still not scientifically an established thing. Absolutely. You know, for example, when you ground habitually, an abnormal cortisol profile tends to normalize over time. If a person is having an issue with sleeping, it tends to improve when you ground. When they test the people's brainwave activity to grounding versus sham grounding, what you find is that people who are grounding get a shift away from fight and flight brain patterns towards rest and recuperation patterns. Interesting. When you ground, the effective viscosity of your blood is immediately decreased that second by a factor of 3. Your blood becomes much, much thinner immediately. Disconnect from the earthing and it thickens right back up within a very short period, like seconds, for example. Wounds tend to heal more rapidly in both human and animal models, for example. There are all sorts of things that go on associated with grounding.
And you would say that it's basically because of... a bit. Yeah, sorry. So would you say that is based mainly on around the electrons, right? The electrons that the Earth donates to our body while being grounded on the Earth?
Exactly. We evolved grounded to the Earth. We lived on the Earth. We walked around on the Earth. We slept on the Earth. We were supposed to be a part of the Earth's magnetic field. In the last 100 years or so, we've electrically disconnected ourselves from the Earth most of the time. So now we're living in a way that we weren't evolved for.
All right.
So yes, perfect. When you ground, what happens is your body will absorb electrons from the Earth into your body and thus have all sorts of effects, including antioxidant effect, actually.
Yeah. They neutralize free radicals, basically. No, so that's what causes inflammation for the right part of the body. Yeah, it's really interesting. It's really interesting. Plus, it's free, so it's not going to harm you. It's not going to do anything to you. So why not? You know,
that's it.
Why not include that? So also another concept that's being tossed around a lot is insulin resistance, and you've talked a lot about the Randall cycle now. In Mexico, people are catching up with that. With the insulin resistance part, like doctors are barely starting to talk about that, but definitely I've never heard anyone talk about the Randall cycle. Could you quickly tell us a brief introduction of what Randall cycle is and what is it versus insulin resistance?
Yeah, right. So the Randall cycle, first of all, probably shouldn't be called a cycle because it's not. It's a bunch of various aspects of your metabolism that act and interact and react with each other in such a way as to lead to the following situation, basically. If your mitochondria are largely using carbohydrates as a substrate for oxidative phosphorylation, then those mitochondria tend to prefer to continue doing that. It's a form of entropy, really. A thing will continue to do what it's doing until a force powerful enough to prevent it from doing that or to cause it to do something different is used. The same is true when your mitochondria are oxidizing mostly fat for oxidative phosphorylation, they would prefer to continue to do that. It takes quite a bit of sugar to stop fat oxidation and set the metabolism running back that way. And basically what I'm saying is they counteract each other. They cross-inhibit one another. So if you have a diet which is highly, which has a mix of carbohydrates and fats, then they will cross-inhibit each other and the actual energetic state of the mitochondria will suffer. Ergo, the inorganic phosphate level in the cells will build up. Ergo, you will get AMP kinase mediated issues and you will get pro-inflammatory cytokines being activated by the increased inorganic phosphate level in the cell, etc. Bad thing, basically. So the secret to avoiding the Randall cycle issue is to eat a diet which is rich in fat and poor in carbohydrates, or rich in carbohydrates and poor in fat, not to have a mixed diet. Mixed is not your friend. Mixed is the worst possible diet you can eat, actually. The very thing that they're telling us, you should have a mixed diet, you should have a balanced diet. No, you shouldn't. You should do no such thing. Then what you need to do to decide whether you're going to eat the diet which is rich in carbohydrates or the one that's poor in carbohydrates is you need to compare those two diets in terms of the nutritional componentry as compared against human requirements. And you'll find out that one of those diets is absolutely completely destitute of nutrients for a human being. And it's the one that's rich in carbohydrate and poor in fats. It's the plant-based diet, which is the one that's the second worst diet you can consume. The winner, the best diet is carnivore. Why? Well, let's go back to what have we been eating demonstrably, absolutely and without question, for at least 100 and something thousand years. Ah, well, it's meat and fat, so perhaps we should keep doing that.
Nice and simple. Nice and simple. And yeah. What would you say? What about insulin resistance? Should people continue using insulin resistance as a way to explain what's going on?
I wouldn't use the term myself. I think it's a very poor term because insulin resistance is a construct, meaning something that has been put together. It's an idea. It's a concept. It's not a physiological thing. There is no level of insulin resistance that you can go and buy an insulin resistance meter to measure. It's not a physiological signal. It's a mathematical sum that you have to put things that you actually can measure into. Those things are blood glucose and blood insulin levels. And then you go, calculate the result, please. Tell me what my insulin resistance level is. Oh, okay. The other thing that's problematic about insulin resistance is it is claimed to be a pathology and it is claimed to be the etiology of diabetes type 2, which is not true. It's nothing of the sort. The thing that's being touted to be called insulin resistance is, in fact, the Randall cycle doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's blocking sugar out from the cells that would otherwise damage those cells were it allowed to enter according to its concentration gradient. So the sacrificial lambs become the red blood cells, mostly, and the vascular endothelial cells, both of which can be replaced very, very quickly because they're quite simple cells, and they're normally replaced very, very quickly. That's the biological design. As opposed to a much more complex cell, which takes quite a bit more to get replaced. So instead of destroying, for example, all our muscle cells by letting sugar pour into them and glycate them all, we block that off when we have enough energy in the form of fats or carbohydrates or both. So the cell is saying, we're full now, we have all the energy we need, we're not going to accept any more energy. And so therefore, while insulin is a key that can open the cell to glucose from the external compartment, allowing those GLUT4 transporters to transport glucose in, there's another key that can be locked on the inside saying, even if there is insulin, we're not interested, thanks. So that's what's happening. That's what the Randall cycle is. It's basically locking that door from the inside. saying, we're done here for now. We have all the fuel on board that's required for the foreseeable future. Any more would be damaging because sugar is toxic at high levels inside cells. So we're not going to have that. And that's all it is. It's not a pathology. It's your body doing exactly what it ought to do. The solution to so-called disordered carbohydrate metabolism is to stop eating carbohydrates. The exact number of required carbohydrates in the human diet per day? Not one, zero, per day ever. Your body is capable of manufacturing all the glucose that's required itself from non-glucose precursors, and no, it's not a stress for the body to do that. It's designed to do it. It's part of the normal, natural metabolic processes as outlined in any metabolic pathway tree you like. The one that's specific for human beings is probably the best one.
Yeah, because that's also another comment right there. Right? The cortisol levels increase a lot with the ketogenic diet. Be careful of that. It's another very common comment they say. And I guess what you mentioned there.
Cortisol is a stress hormone? No, it isn't. No.
True.
Stress is one of the things that can lead to an aberrant cortisol profile. But cortisol itself is not a stress hormone. It doesn't cause stress by being there. And neither is it necessarily symptomatic of stress. It's a multi-purpose messenger. Sorry, go on. I interrupted you.
No, that's perfect. Actually, there's a lot of ideas here that I think people have never heard of, especially in the Spanish-speaking community, and I think they need to hear it. Unfortunately, time is short, so we'll definitely have to come back and see those things more deeply. But moving on, going back a bit with the Randall cycle, so basically that's why microvascular damage, the first type of damage that occurs in people with high sugar levels, because they're the sacrificial lamb, the endothelial cells. And guess that could explain why renal failure is the number one cause of renal failure in the world is type 2 diabetes, because in the end of the day, the glomerulus, I don't know how you say it in English, I forgot the name. And the end of the day, it's a capillary. It's a sophisticated capillary. Yeah. So part of the vasculature. So people, that's important to take into consideration. And in the carnivore space, has been growing a lot in the United States. And now you have influencers of all types, people who are perhaps not even medical, who are not of a medical profession or in the healthcare profession. Not that that's bad. You know, I'm glad there's a lot of people talking about this. And I honestly think a lot of medical people do not have any ounce of nutritional education. So I love it that everyone's kind of talking about it and sharing their experience. But I would say carnivore has different flavors now. Like there's a lot of subgroups, I would say, like little tiny tribes. Yeah. What would you consider the biggest misconceptions being propagated in the carnivore space right now about the carnivore diet?
You do not need a single ounce of carbohydrate, sugar, fruit, or honey in your diet ever. No, you don't. That's the biggest miscomprehension. Number one, as far as I'm concerned. Number two, you do not need to be concerned what level of lipoprotein of any kind is in your blood at any time ever. No, you don't. Ergo, you do not need to intervene or even attempt to intervene pharmacologically or otherwise via diet to attempt to affect a change of any of the level of any of the lipoproteins or any subfraction of the lipoproteins in your blood at any time ever. No, you don't need to do that. Thirdly, you do not need a single gram of fiber, ever, not one. You will still be able to go to the toilet. You will, of course, on a carnivore diet, go to the toilet probably slightly less often in the first year, and then it will even out to daily after that probably. And the volume of your stools will be much smaller. There'll be much less waste because, well, you can absorb almost everything you eat as a carnivore as opposed to on a plant-based diet where you can absorb almost none of it, in fact. Fourthly, red meat is not even meaningfully associated with increased cancer rates, let alone the cause of it. Absolute nonsense. Not true either. All of these imbeciles, these theologues running around trying to teach people their religion, and I'm talking mostly about the vegans and the people that say that animal products are bad for you and meat is bad for you and saturated fat is bad for you and all this kind of utter claptrap, I think they're doing a huge disservice because none of those things are supported by science. Not at all. There you go. There it is in a nutshell.
Oh, perfect. That's pretty beautiful, cool. Action.
Good.
Fantastic. And what do you say actually to those people who take things, I would call them a bit fragile people, who think you're perhaps very arrogant or too straightforward with people or perhaps being too harsh on the vegans or on the omnivores?
Good. Yep. Good. Okay. In terms of arrogance, if you look up arrogant in the dictionary, it's inappropriate or over self-confidence that's not backed up by runs on the board. Well, my confidence is absolutely backed up with runs on the board. My academic CV, my clinical practice CV, my attracted external consultancies register of various organizations that have paid me a lot of money for my opinion, all absolutely above reproach, despite what the vegans will tell you. Oh, no, he's just made it all up, they'll say. Well, that's fine. I don't actually care if anyone thinks I made it all up or not. It's all actually pretty well signed and sealed above board for anyone that wants to actually do the proper research into me to find out what my background is. So, no, I'm not arrogant. Maybe I have strongly held opinions, but my strongly held opinions are on the basis of more than two decades of being involved in producing the science, consulting with folks and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So no, I'm not arrogant. Perfect. I just know what I'm talking about. In terms of, am I too harsh on these people? Well, no, because they are actually the ones who are arrogant. They are the ones with what we call Dunning-Kruger syndrome. For those that don't know what Dunning-Kruger is, it's someone who is so destitute of competence that they are unable to see their own level of incompetence. They think they're clever. They think they have the answers. They think they're right. And as such, the only way to combat that is with shock and awe. Plus, when I first started trying to be a social media influencer, I thought what I'd do is I would just say the science in a dispassionate way. I wouldn't say any naughty words. I wouldn't get emotional about it. I wouldn't have any, you know, I would just say, well, these are the facts. Nobody watched it. Nobody was interested. But as soon as I started using naughty four-letter words and indeed using double banger versions, putting a hyphen in and using two of them at once, for example, suddenly I had an audience. Now I was funny and people wanted to see who was wrong on the interwebs this week and what was I going to say about this, that or the other thing. And then I started using that as a subterfuge way of educating people before they realize I've done it. And the rest is history, really. So my persona online, the swearing and the carrying on and the being cross with these people, I am genuinely cross because these people are hurting people by lying to them and by not understanding their own level of incompetence, basically. But the way I present that by being overtly, clearly playing the role of someone who is really, really angry personally at somebody and swearing at them and stuff, well, that's just for clicks. Because none of these people are important enough in my life to matter a hill of beans. None of them. Yeah. So that explains all of that. And if you don't like my style, well, don't watch my videos. That's no skin off my nose either. But you won't learn you probably won't learn half of what you could learn from me from many of these other influences. And I'm not saying, aren't I great and everyone else sucks, but basically what I'm saying is I'm really great and everyone else sucks. You should come and listen to me because I'm the science. Trust me, I'm safe and effective. Don't question the science.
Basically TM. And So later on, I don't know if it's okay with you at the end of the, near the end of the stream, if we can ask some questions from the audience, are you okay with that? Okay.
Sure.
Perfect. So we've to close up that last question. Do you think a lot of these vegans, I'm going to talk about vegans because I think they're the most loudest in many of the cases.
Yeah.
Do you think they come out of a place of malice or just plain ignorance? Or what is it exactly? What do you consider?
Well, some of them come from a place of malice towards humanity. To some degree or another, to adopt, to embrace a vegan ideal is to be anti-human. Because the appropriate species-specific diet for a human being that has evolved in a specific niche, like every other animal on the planet, is hypercarnivore. That is absolutely established beyond any question. Even though we don't have sharp pointy teeth like this, we are still absolutely evolved for the eating of the flesh of animals. And that's what we should do. So to say anything other than that comes from a place of being anti-human. Whether each individual vegan is actually themselves genuinely anti-human, or whether they themselves are just destitute of an understanding of all of this and have been influenced by someone who is themselves overtly evil, I think it's, for most people, it's the latter. The people that make me the most, most people are just ignorant. And some of them absolutely stunningly ignorant. Some of them, for example, have no more than a high school diploma behind them, and they come online as if they're the great bloody scientist. I'm talking about you, Richard Burgess, otherwise known as Vegan Gaines. A boy who lacks the courage to face me face-to-face for a debate. Of course he won't come and debate anything with me, but he will try and present himself as not only a competent, but he even presents himself as an expert commentator on the science. Well, how is that possible when you've got a high school diploma and no more? Interesting. But he's not overtly an evil individual. He's just a very, very ignorant little boy. The evil people are these people with significant education in another field, and I'm talking about the medical professionals, who then present themselves as being competent in nutrition because they have a medical degree. No, that's like me saying I have X number of degrees in physiology, ergo I am now an expert in electronics, and you need to consult with me about your electronics product project. Only if you want your electronics project messed up beyond recognition. And that's what you're going to get from most medical professionals if you ask them about nutrition and diet and physiology and statistics and research methodology. They've got a clue. That's not in their training. And then they're using this thing, vegan doctor. I'm one of the vegan doctors. There's no such thing as a vegan doctor. Doctors are not trained in nutrition one way or the other. And you're leaning on your so-called credibility as a medical professional to make yourself out to be expert in nutrition. That's ridiculous. Anyway, that's my rant.
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree. And I think that also applies to a lot of carnivore doctors as well. Perhaps I also include myself. Yeah. I am not an expert at this. I'm reading. I am educating myself constantly. I'm trying to go into harder sciences. But yeah, I don't know a lot about statistics. Definitely not nowhere near as what a statistician would know. So yeah, I think there's that goes both ways, basically. Yeah. So
absolutely.
Also,
yes, I agree. And I've also done critiques on some of the so-called carnivore speakers, like Paul Salad. I don't know. I've done a number of videos about how ridiculous everything that comes out of that boy's mouth is. For example, he's not the only one, of course. There are others, but that's for another day. Yeah,
totally. I agree. And okay. So also another great myth that I've been getting a lot. Well, not myth, question I've been getting on my channel a lot. Zone 2 cardio. Like that's another sacred goat, I would say, amongst the health group people. So why does the science say that zone 2 cardio is great for you? And is it great for you?
Well, the science doesn't say that, in fact. Some of the people who claim to be involved in the physiological sciences say that. It's their interpretation of the model that they were taught of how physiology works. Unfortunately, the very model that's taught in exercise physiology, for example, from the ground up in terms of muscle energetics, is absolutely false. And so there are people up to and including people who hold PhDs in exercise physiology working off a model that is demonstrably false. The one that suggests you have three energy systems, an aerobic one and two anaerobic ones. No, that's false. So anything that you say based on that, which is why they say zone 2 training is good for you, to cut through all the and get to the punchline. Well, it's false, isn't it? Because your model's false. And they can't understand why what they're saying is false because they believe the model. And what they're saying is correct according to the model. Unfortunately, the model is false. Yeah.
So what would be the best type of exercise for the average person to do?
Well, a human being, again, if you look at how we evolved and how we have likely spent most of our time, a human being does very, very low intensity work for a significant period of time, walking, some kind of manual household labor of some kind, or, you know, that kind of thing, i.e. at a level where the heart rate doesn't get much over the resting orthostatic heart rate. It's not hard work. It's not taxing on the oxidative system. You don't get puffed. You don't get all hot and sweaty unless, of course, you're standing in the sun sort of thing. It's not really what you would consider to be exercise training. It's just incidental activity. So there's that. Or you go from that to flat stick. All out efforts of defending yourself and your family against invading others or animals or whatever, or hunting, or, you know, those kind of activities where it's all top end power, get something done rapidly. There is nothing in our background that would suggest that we have evolved to be or are indeed any good at endurance activity. The stuff that's the middle of the range of intensity that goes on for a significant amount of time, like hours and hours and hours and hours a week. No, we never did any of that. And the physiological adaptations in a human being to that kind of activity, some of them are deemed to be positive, like mitochondrial proliferation, for example. Although you could question as to whether that's a good thing or not, frankly. If you're actually thinking holistically, if you have joined up thinking. However, what's not talked about are the negative outcomes of doing hours and hours and hours and hours of so-called zone two aerobic training every week, every year, whatever. Things like, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy over years, for example. Things like the fact that that zone two training will strip muscle mass off a person rather than add any on to speak of. Both negative things. The fact that you will find that these kind of endurance athletes at some point in their lives have to stop doing that, and suddenly a large portion of those people gain massive weight and get so-called type 2 diabetes. As a result, because they're unable to change their diets, which have been inappropriate all along, by the way, because you do not need to eat a bunch of carbohydrate to perform well in exercise. That is also false, demonstrably false. How do I know? Because I have myself demonstrated it scientifically. Okay, it's in the literature. It's published. If people knew where to go and look and find that, perhaps they would. I think that covers it off, really. It's just not a mode of activity that is appropriate for our species. It's not what we've evolved doing. It's dumb stuff.
Yeah, and I think you can also use common sense. You don't have to be a scientist to figure it out. I mean, you can see a person who runs marathons, who dedicates his life to do marathons. Yeah. You can compare to a sprinter whose body looks healthier. I think that's just common sense. Anyone can apply. Yeah. So that's
and
the beauty of it.
Longer? Assuming that neither one takes the gear, because obviously you take the gear, all the bits are off on your lifespan, aren't they? Because, well,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, like, I think a lot of times common sense can help a lot in these types of situations where the science isn't very clear. And so you also speak a lot about what are the best habits for either reversing certain diseases or controlling them. Mm. Or simply having a long and healthy life. I believe you mentioned it's five things. Could you please go over them?
I have a video on my YouTube channel. If you want to find my YouTube channel, go to YouTube and type in @BART-KAY and you'll find me. right? On that channel, on the main channel, there's a video called Five Health Hacks You Need to Know, where I'm doing that on the thumbnail for two reasons. One, so that you can see there are indeed five. And number two, so that you can see the palm of my hand, thus making me trustworthy, I'm told. Good. So basically the five lifestyle hacks or health hacks I outlined in that video are designed to lead a person to the lowest likelihood that they are going to have a chronic systemic inflammatory overburden, which would predispose them to a likelihood of any of the diseases which actually do have their etiological underpinnings, their cause, in inflammation. And those diseases include heart disease, atherosclerosis. That is an inflammatory condition. It is not a metabolic condition. It is not a lipid dysfunction. It is an inflammatory disease, period. Okay? Type 2 diabetes is an inflammatory condition. Right? Not a disordered metabolism. Your metabolism is working perfectly, as we've outlined. The assumption that leads to people thinking that the metabolism is faulty in someone with diabetes type 2 is the assumption that a person should be able to tolerate eating a huge ton of carbohydrates, and not being able to makes that person abnormal now. No, you never needed any carbohydrates in the first place. And the solution to the type 2 diabetes is still the same. Stop eating carbohydrates. What else is on that list? Many forms of cancer are inflammatory. Again, this is not a metabolic disorder. This is an inflammatory disorder. Many forms of dementia. Some of them are even now being labeled as forms of diabetes in and of themselves. They're saying Alzheimer's is type 3 diabetes now. Some of them, they. Basically, what I'm telling you is all the big killers in Western society, the stuff that outlines and describes the reason for death for 90-something percent of people, all inflammatory disorders. That's why you should learn about my five patented anti-inflammatory life hacks by viewing them on my channel in that playlist, in that video that talks about them.
I'll add in the description below.
Outline them now or not?
Playlist.
Yeah.
Yes, please. Yes.
We can
briefly.
Outline them quickly. They are a 100% carnivore diet, a 100% carnivore diet, or as close to that as you can possibly maintain in your lifestyle. Don't change your diet from anything to anything else rapidly. Do a slow transition over 6 to 8 weeks. Second thing is the three main oral supplemental products from a company called Cerule, with whom I am joint ventured. And yes, I will get a commission if you buy their products, for full disclosure. Why do I support their products? Not because I get paid a commission for doing so, but because they have changed my life and thousands of other people, many of whom I am personally acquainted with, some of them quite closely. It's a great product. It does exactly what it says it does. It is a adult stem cell release agent called Stem Enhance Ultra. There is an anti-inflammatory called Cyactive and a blood flow optimization agent called Plasma Flow. Those three together on a daily basis, fantastic. Step 3 is to ground yourself electrically as much of the time as is possible. We discussed that earlier. Step 4 is to block blue light from your eyes after dark. I presume that's why you've got the orange glasses on right now. Good plan.
Yes.
It's daytime where I am. By the way, I'm on the other side of the world, so that's why it's daytime here and it's nighttime there. So that's a bit of a shame for most of you flat earthers too, isn't it? Whoopsie. How can it be nighttime where Fernando is and daytime where I am if the earth is flat and the sun is above it? How does that work? Go on, we'll wait. What else? Number 5 on my list of 5 things is high-intensity burst and repeat exercise, HIIT and or resistance training, the kind of exercise you should do, the stuff that avoids the middle. Do that for 45 minutes, 3 or 4 times a week. Jobs are good. And there it is. That's my patented plan for reducing one's inflammatory overburden.
Nice and simple, right? Okay, yep. Fantastic. I love simple. I think people love that too. So, okay, so we're running out of time.
Science,
so.
Remember, don't question the science.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So real quick, have you had any problems with censorship on YouTube or anywhere else?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. But it's not overt censorship. Well, I have had some overt censorship. I've had various films taken down off my channel at various times because they were in breach of YouTube's rules. Even the ones that I put up that weren't in breach of the rules when I posted them up, and then later they have changed the rules and decided to retrospectively apply the rules that didn't apply at the time I made those videos to those videos. That makes sense, doesn't it? All the sense in the world. So, yes, that has happened. But mostly the censorship that I receive from major platforms, legacy platforms, shall we say, is in my message not being in line with the accepted narrative. Ergo, I get what's called shadow banning, the thing that they will claim left, right, and center that does not exist. Well, yes, it does. And I could show people my metrics in my back office of what happens when and what's associated with what, and you'll be in no doubt whatsoever as to exactly what goes on in terms of shadow banning. Yes, I have absolutely suffered hugely at the hands of the legacy platforms in terms of them having a say over my visibility. Yeah.
And do you also have a problem then with managing, or not managing, I guess, having followers on different platforms? Because I believe you also publish your videos on another platform where there is a bit less censorship, I would assume. Is that a problem for you? That like your followers spread out?
No, not at all. I generally have my YouTube offerings also syndicated to another platform that claims to be less censor oriented, more free speech oriented, shall we say. And I've got that set to just automatically upload on both platforms. People have a choice where they want to watch for now. But at some point, all of those of us who say things that are not in line with the accepted narrative are all realistic that we expect at some point that our visibility will be turned down as far as zero. And then people won't have a choice. They'll have to go to the alternate platforms to see us speak from that point, because we won't be allowed to speak anymore on the legacy platforms.
So I'm guessing you're, I don't know if you're still shopping around, but are you looking for a, would you like to have a social media presence that cannot be canceled? I'm guessing the answer is yes to that.
Yes, I've heard various, and I'm aware of the Nostra one, but I haven't looked into it particularly closely yet. Perhaps you and I can talk about that behind the scenes and see whether it's a good fit for what I do and how I do it or not.
I would totally agree.
I'm aware that that platform is involved in cryptocurrency in some way, but then...
No, it's not involved in cryptocurrency. It's like its own thing, and on top of it, you have Bitcoin. Just Bitcoin.
Right.
Okay. Maybe they're starting to build things with some other coins, but right now it's basically just Bitcoin. We can talk about that later on, because there's a kind of a division between Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. There's kind of, people would kill me if I accept that as the truth, but okay. Sure. Anyways. Yeah, exactly.
Let me ask you a question. Is Bitcoin or is it not a cryptocurrency?
I would say it is considered a cryptocurrency, but I think when you put in Bitcoin with cryptocurrencies, like in that basket, you consider it a shitcoin along with Ethereum, Solana, and all these other things. The major thing is that Bitcoin is decentralized while the others are not. So that's why Bitcoiners kind of like to differentiate. But yeah, I honestly do say it's a cryptocurrency.
You can school me on the day. Cryptocurrency ladder. I don't know anything about it. Yeah. So that's fine.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, we'll say that for another day. And so, because that's important, because right now I have some questions from people on Oster. So I'm going to ask you some, right? Yeah, so here we go. So
let's go.
So when join Oster, Bart? I want to pay you for your fruit and honey takedown videos. I also get nervous when people like yourself speak so much truth power on YouTube. That ban hammer is always lingering. Noster is a solution to having your audience all in one place. Fernando can help explain. Because that's the thing. With Noster, it's not like if you get banned on YouTube, you lose all your followers. And then Only yeah. those who might know your alternative platform will follow you. On Ostr, that doesn't happen because it's heavily decentralized. If you get banned, let's say, on a certain app, you can just open up your profile in a different app and you have all the followers that you had and nothing gets banned because it basically, Ostr is a protocol. And on top of the protocol, you build all these different apps. So all your information is always going to be in the space layer that's heavily decentralized, which we can talk about later. So the question is basically...
Yeah, we need to, and you'll also need to understand that I am a technophobe, and anytime you start talking about this kind of stuff, I'm going to glaze over because it's while these things might be great, they might be good ideas, they are completely fucking incomprehensible to the average human being.
And so it's been simplified, though. It's been simplified because there's like certain, the first use case has been social media and they've developed these apps that are basically a Twitter-like experience. You can speak to Dr. Kimberry actually about that.
Yeah, I'm aware that he's involved in it as well. In terms of to answer the question, when am I going to join Ostr? I don't know if I ever will. It depends on whether I can get to a decent understanding of what the thing even is as to whether it's any good for me or not. And secondly, you saying that I'm not a member of Ostr, therefore you can't pay me, is nonsense. You can pay me right now if you want to, whoever wrote that question. You have the absolute ability to pay me for all my videos right now if you want. Just send me an email and I'll give you a number of payment opportunities for you. I can give you a PayPal address. I can give you a Patreon that you can join on a subscription basis to pay me every month if you want to.
So all right, perfect.
Stopping you right now. Great. What's next?
Next question. Which carnivore voice? Oh, sorry. Which carnivore voice do you believe is the most underrated?
Which carnivore is the most underrated?
Which carnivore voice? Yeah. Do you?
Me. I am. Yeah.
All right. Well, 50,000 subscribers. Yes, I do. I agree. You bring down a lot of truth.
Here's the thing. When you look at your YouTube back office and it says how many subscribers you've got, that's an AI generated number. It's not a count.
Oh, okay.
They decide what your followership is.
Didn't know that.
Most people don't understand that either. No. Yeah.
Last question, because I know we're running out of time. What are your thoughts on coffee?
Coffee is a recreational drug. Some people claim benefits in their use scenario, in their N equals one. And I would say to any person, if something in your life isn't broken, then perhaps don't fix it. That said, the requirement, the dietary requirement for coffee is none, ever. And does it have potential downsides? Yes, you bet. I'll give you an example from myself. I was at one point very dependent on coffee and drinking too much coffee. I got up to 12 cups a day at one point.
Wow.
I had an issue with my blood pressure, shock horror. I cut the coffee back to 3 cups a day and my blood pressure normalized. For example, and we know that one of the absolute causal underpinnings of heart disease is elevated blood pressure chronically. So there you go.
Do you continue to drink coffee up to this day?
I do, about 3 cups a day now. Yep.
And my 3 blood cups pressure still. Is
completely
okay.
Normal. Yep.
Perfect. All right, so, Professor Barkay. We've run out of time. I don't know if you want to end with a certain comment before or share other places where people can follow you, not just on YouTube, or you prefer to send everyone to YouTube?
Sure. I mean, YouTube is my first and foremost still because I'm still allowed to be there and it's where the most audience is. Despite my problems with that platform, the way it's run, the ideology behind the people that run it and the company that owns it, it is still the best place for me to send people because that's where my biggest potential audience is. All these other either obscure or less obscure platforms that do exist are all great in their own way and have their own limitations as well. None of them, even without shadow banning me, can produce anything like the same sort of audience for me. And I've shown that by being a member of, for example, Odyssey platform. I've been on Odyssey for a number of years. Has all the so-called 52,000 subs I have on YouTube gone and joined my Odyssey channel? No, they haven't. Not close. I also have 5 or 6 other YouTube channels, by the way, other than my main channel. Do I have the same 50,000 on all? Have people gone and subbed to all my YouTube channels? No, they haven't. No. But yes, I'm on Odyssey, O-D-Y-S-E-E platform. I'm also on Instagram, Bart_KAY_nutrition. And there's another bloke who hangs out with me sometimes called Ted. He was around before, but I don't know where he is right now. Ted has not been seen at the camouflage training. He was here. Anyway, Ted has his own X account, the platform formerly known as Twitter. He's called HRH_Ted, if you want to follow him and his exploits, where he swears even more than I do. I can't do a thing with him. I keep telling him to tone it down, but he just keeps getting worse, frankly. But he also knows as much as I do about science somehow. Anyway,
perfect.
So you can do that. You'll also find me, did I mention Instagram?
Not yet.
Yeah, that's Bart_K_nutrition. Yeah, there we go.
I'll add all on the show notes. And I do recommend Bart's Patreon. There's a course, the anti-anxiety course, A Wealth of Knowledge. I think it's undervalued, and I really recommend you guys check it out. You want to learn a bit more about the carnivore diet and all the benefits. He goes deep into from biochemistry, and he also simplifies things from his she's on the video as well, but she talks about psychology.
Pim, yes, she is
Pim. Yes,
yeah, Pim, P-I-M. She's my partner in crime, and also my partner in a number of peer-reviewed publications as well in another life. She's got some good ideas on basically her specialization is dealing with folks that have addictive eating behaviors, etc. That's her thing. Well, at least that has been her thing, but now that we've bought a farm, she's going to be a farmer.
That is awesome. Living the dream New Zealand. Awesome. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Professor Bart K, thank you very much. I feel things were kind of rushed here, but I want to squeeze as much information as I could out of you. So thank you for joining and coming on.
My pleasure.
Take care.